Since its founding, Chicago has always been a forward-thinking place. As a city located by a river that ties the north and south, and a railroad connecting the east to the west, Chicago is where people come to get their groove on.
Right now at the Chicago History Museum, there's a great exhibit, Out in Chicago, chronicling how people in the Windy City have organized their lives around their sexual desires and sense of self. The first and largest exhibit of its kind, Out in Chicago gives visitors a powerful sense of what life was like for people before the words gay, lesbian, bi, and trans came to be.
Joining us today are historians Jill Austin and Jennifer Breyer, who helped put together this amazing exhibit by mining the History Museum's very own archives for hidden clues.
Listen as we talk to these fascinating women about outing historical figures, secret gay codes, and how gay men cruised at the turn of the century.
Plus, did President Nixon accidentally help ignite the gay rights movement in Chicago? Was he really gay all along?
Chicago's publishing past and the battle between gay publications.
Charlie Chaplin looked hot and drag in the film A Woman, made right here in our own backyard at the SNA Studios.
Red neckties, the history of lesbian potluck party flyers, and what the future of your community will be like.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Discover 150 years of urban history through the lens of gender, sexuality, and nonconformity. Chicago History Museum is the first of its kind with the largest exhibit featuring the colorful, diverse LGBT, transgender, bisexual, gay, lesbian history here in Chicago. And today we're very excited to have Jill Austin and Jennifer Breyer, two of the fantastic ladies who put this exhibit together, on our podcast to talk about this extraordinary exhibit. Welcome to Feast of Fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So how did this all come together?
The History Museum decided that they wanted to do an LGBT history exhibit, and they asked us.
Okay, Jenny.
Yeah.
And the plans were in the works before I came on to the museum in 2005. This had all been...
So they dumped this in your lap.
No, they asked very nicely.
And so, I mean, why do they want to dedicate so much resources, so much energy to doing such a beautiful job of capturing over 100 years of gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgendered history? Queer history.
Yeah. It's a really good question. They had a long-standing commitment. They had been doing this Out at CHM program for several years before the exhibit, which is still going on. So there's one happening on the 9th of February and one in March. And so those had happened three times a year for, I think, 3 or 4 years before the exhibit planning even started. So it was an idea that the exhibit would be a culmination of this public program, which regularly packs the house at the museum.
What is the public program? It's a speaker comes in and talks about gay history.
A speaker comes in and talks about gay history. I mean, so just to think about that for a second, usually that might happen in a university and you get 50 people, maybe 100 people, but these would get 400 people in the wintertime coming to hear about gay history. And so there was really a sense of desire to have that history be told. And I think the History Museum really bravely decided that they were going to do this history exhibition. And then Jill, who's on staff at the museum, her time was dedicated to that. And they asked me as a local lesbian historian to join Jill in making this happen. So I think that they were really trying to do something pathbreaking.
And was there any controversy or hesitation on behalf of the museums or its sponsors or its donors to say, you know, this might attract a lot of negative press for our distinguished organization?
I think that there was some concern about that.
Yeah.
And Gary Johnson, our president, was concerned. We were always hoping that we would attract controversy, that we would attract protesters outside, and it hasn't happened.
So you sent a press release to the Phelps family.
And they didn't show up.
We invited them for a complimentary tour. No. I think that was something that the museum, the board, the trustees have long been committed to, the idea of doing this exhibition, as Jenny said. The path for it began some 10 years ago when the museum decided to really be as inclusive as possible and make the museum of the history of the city everybody's history.
Sure.
And so I think people were really on board and have supported it for many years. As we got closer to the opening date and during the fundraising process, people started to get more nervous and really wonder, you know, what's going to happen here? What are we doing in this gallery?
Well, because it is a little tricky. I mean, you guys are starting the exhibit with everyday people's clothing from all different walks of life, you know. And so you have like a leather man, of course, which you always have to have. And you have a lesbian couple, which one wears a tuxedo, the other one wears a dress. And I mean, how did you guys go about like picking and choosing what these dummies and costumes were going to be?
Well, we don't call them dummies.
I mean, the mannequins.
Mannequins. Sorry.
They are our...
Not the people. I mean,
they are our voices of the community. Not dummies.
Before we get through like what's actually in the exhibit, I want to talk a little bit first about you had the concept of mining the museum. Because what you found is when you were putting this thing together is that a lot of the stuff that you actually have on display, you already had.
Mm-hmm. That was, for us, I think, one of the amazing things about working in this institution. I think there was this idea that the History Museum would put on this show and we would have to borrow all of this stuff. And it was like, the History Museum isn't a gay space necessarily, yet has this public program and it has these gay people who come into it and they're gay funders and they're gay people on the board. But it wasn't really like gayness wasn't part or queerness wasn't part of the museum. And what Jill and I really decided to do was look inside the museum and see what was there.
Already there. And so you were like sort of like focusing instead of like on the rich white people in the picture, you were looking at the black people in the background.
Exactly.
And so but instead you were looking for the gayness in the exhibit. How did
the gayness in the museum?
The pictures, the artifacts. I mean, have it like a card catalog for this contains a gay person in it, or how'd that go?
That's an excellent point. That's what I was just going to say. I mean, you start off by, you know, we all came with our own, you know, what, you know, Jenny knows about this history and what we know about the community and what we assume this could all be, and then we started going beyond the keywords. We're looking for and finding pieces in the collection that aren't keyworded queer, that aren't keyworded LGBT in any way. And they were collected for different reasons, but they document so many aspects of
the queer past.
Of the queer past in Chicago.
So how did you discover it? Were you just kind of like going through the books? Were you in the warehouse saying, this might be gay, this might not be gay, or something along that lines?
Jill and I were really lucky. We had amazing research assistants who were fearless and some of the most determined people I've ever met. So the example that I would give is we have an incredible newspaper collection at the Chicago History Museum. And it is both community newspapers, but it's also newspapers that have long been the city's newspapers. So the Chicago Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, dating back to the 1850s. And one of my researchers, Ann Parsons, who's a student of mine at UIC, committed herself to finding every representation of a gender crosser from 1850 to the present. So this is a collection.
How long does that take?
Well, so luckily it's digital.
Okay.
But it means that she had to come up with 20 different terms to be looking for.
So like what were some examples?
Some examples. So, you can't just type in transgender and think that you're going to find something from 1850.
Yeah.
But you can type in things like man woman does, you know, man woman comes to city or
he she.
Well, they don't use she. Okay. They would use a male name with a female pronoun to talk about a female bodied person who was passing as a man. So there are these great headlines. He was not a girl. So she learned the vernacular of the time period and used it to search digitally for people who crossed genders, who we would today call transgender in one form or another.
And you certainly found more than one.
We found hundreds.
People that had mostly been arrested.
mostly people who had been arrested. Mm-hmm. Some people we found. So the overwhelming number in the 19th century are female bodied people who dress as men, mm-hmm. whether it's to come to the city to get work, mm-hmm. whether it's to come to the city, whether it's easier to travel as a man than it is as a woman on the trains in 1870 or 1880, or whether it's female-bodied people who want to make their lives with other women. The only way you could do that is if you were appeared to be male.
Mm. And the results of that research really made a huge impact, an unexpected impact, on the course of how we developed the exhibit and how we really shaped that first section as you walk into the gallery.
On gender and identity.
Yeah.
We had no idea that transgender history would be so important.
Well, I remember you telling us when we first saw went through the tour of the exhibit, you kind of wanted to represent people as they are today. Mm-hmm. And so that people could immediately say, oh, this is about me and somebody that I could identify with.
But it's tricky because it can't be, you can't just be looking for yourself in the past. Mm-hmm. So that was a strategy for us to bring people in that first space, but then to say, and you won't find yourself again. Mm-hmm. But you'll find people who are your kin, who are your people, mm-hmm. but they don't look exactly like you.
So you chose about eight mannequins mm-hmm. with everyday costumes to sort of greet people as they came in the
right.
door. And tell us about how you went about picking these everyday clothing, which actually comes across very costumey mm-hmm. when you actually see it.
Mm-hmm. What I've done as I've recently walked through the exhibition again is to recognize how we have the voice and face of someone who was interviewed greeting us and welcoming us into the gallery, and then we find these costume pieces representing contemporary slice of life in the community that represent butch femme, that represent leather, that represent performance artists who don't identify with any one word, and a bear, for example, and how.
Not an actual diverse, like, teddy bear, but
but a furry big guy
who's also a sister of Perpetual Indulgence.
Yes. That's correct. Yeah, and so I mean, but did you approach these people and say, "We want to stick you in a museum"? And it's like, are they like, "How dare you"?
No, they were excited.
They were excited, and some of them, you know, we did this in such an organic way and through so many different networks and relationships, and so some people did contribute interviews to the project along with the clothing that they lent, and others didn't. And so they're represented in different ways. And some of those people, like Travis, you can learn about as you go through the exhibition.
And in the turn of the century, even up until the year I was born here in Chicago, people were being arrested for wearing, especially women, for wearing jeans.
Yes.
I mean, things that we take for granted every day, here in Chicago, people were being arrested for doing. And
yes.
It's like wearing t-shirts and jeans and, you know, a guy wearing a kilt, for example, might even have been a
well,
little too much.
Unlikely, but yes. Woman wearing pants that zippered in the front until the mid-1940s could have very easily been arrested.
And, of course, you know, the grinder of its day, the social hookup app of its day was the red tie in Chicago,
yes.
We learned. So
Manhunt.
Men mm-hmm. in town would wear a red tie to signify that they were looking for a little hot action.
Yes.
Out on the streets.
Or in Marshall Fields or...
the department store.
Correct.
Yeah.
That is now Macy's.
I have to explain that to people.
Uh-huh.
It's like, what Marshall Fields is.
And how do you discover something like that? Is it like written up in a newspaper or is that oral tradition?
It's both. The thing that's amazing about this project is it is the culmination of where the museum and public history is at, but it's also based on two decades at least of historical research by historians. So whether it's John D'Amelio, my colleague at UIC, who is quoted in the Supreme Court Lawrence v. Texas decision, mm-hmm. Or George Chauncey, our former colleague at the U of C, who's now at Yale, who wrote a book called Gay New York. It's about archival research. And so there's evidence, whether it's in newspaper accounts or oral histories, or whether it's cartoons from the era, from the 19-teens or the 1920s, sort of showing men in spaces where they're together. And one of them had, so it's basically a line drawing, and one of them is wearing a tie, and that's the only thing colored red. Like, that's what it's about an interpretation, but I think it's a well-documented.
Why did men use red ties to identify, gay men used red ties to identify each other? Like, why
the red tie?
And why would other, you know, straight guys or guys who didn't want that kind of attention, when they wore red ties, they're like, uh-oh.
How did that come to be? Well, I think just as there are codes today that we use with each other that will get lost if you try and make us, I sort of joke,
travel like through time.
Well, or even like I joke, like there's a like the lesbian handshake, which of course there isn't, but there is. There's like that eye contact when you walk down the street and someone sees you,
so
and you know,
it's not just the red tie; it's the eye, plus maybe the swoosh in his walk and maybe the look in his
eye. But it's that. But I think that there are there are communal codes.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes they have meaning. The meaning of those codes gets made in the interaction between two people. And if it's with another person who's not in the club, like, it just passes them by.
Yeah. Or women wearing a black ring on their middle finger, for example.
And they've also done studies where they see that, like, straight people kind of don't get gaydar and they don't understand the clue. So a straight person's looking to see that red tie and say, nice red tie. Not know what's behind it.
Yeah.
And then there's the work of not only professional historians, public historians, academic historians, but also people who documented their own lives, like Justin, like Sam Stewart. And Justin Spring is another historian who discovered this card catalog of Sam Stewart's collection and documentation of his own sexual experiences.
And Sam Stewart, for our listeners, who is Sam Stewart?
Oh, he was a tattoo artist in Chicago. He was a professor at DePaul and at Loyola. He was an English professor and an amazing educator who left the academic life to really pursue his own art form. And his tattoo parlor on South State Street catered largely to sailors and recruits from the Great Lakes Naval Station in North Chicago. Mm-hmm. And those sailors were represented sexual opportunities for him as well.
He was, depending on your perspective, he was either Alfred Kinsey, the sort of main sexologist of the mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. He was either his main informant or he was his collaborator. Mm-hmm. Sam Stewart introduced Kinsey to the gay life of Chicago.
And a lot of these individuals in Chicago were what Alfred Kinsey did his study on.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Chicago is a main site of Kinsey's work, and Stewart was his entree into that world.
And so Stewart, he documented every single sexual experience he had.
Yes, in code.
He cross-referenced it.
Correct.
Encoded it. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And he cited the location. And so he provides us with so much information about cruising spaces in Chicago, including places like Marshall Field, where he himself had sexual experiences.
Kinsey did the same thing, too.
No, yeah, exactly.
Well, Justin Spring calls him the secret historian.
Atta girl.
The historian of his own life.
Let's talk about John D'Amelio's contribution and his interesting thesis that the reason why Chicago was able to participate in the gay rights movement so early on was because it was a Democratic stronghold and President Nixon was Republican and against all of what Chicago stood for. Can you explain why Nixon helped advance the gay rights movement in Chicago? This is so fascinating.
Well, John's being a bit of a smarty pants. So that's the first thing I should say. He's trying to be controversial. Yeah. But what he's trying to do, as I understand it, is suggest that one of the reasons why gay people are allowed to have a kind of freedom over the course of the 1970s and 80s that they didn't enjoy before is that the police are stopped by Nixon. So the police are part of the daily machine, right, for most of the 20th century. And even attempts at reforming the police and even protests by gay people saying, don't try and close down our bars, you're attacking us, don't work. The only thing that really works to stop the police is Nixon launching an investigation of the police because he wants to attack Daley.
Daley the father. And so it was really important for the police then to become gay friendly in this town.
The police were shut down.
They were shut down completely. They were not enforcing any laws like that.
They were no longer able to act as
harass.
They were no longer able to harass the way that they had basically made their careers at harassing.
So it's not that Richard Nixon was trying to support the gay rights movement, is that he wanted to shut down police corruption in Chicago, or he was trying to target
Richard Nixon
Daley.
Had no intention of helping gay people.
Or anybody
Even
else except himself.
Even though now it's rumored that he was gay himself, or at least bisexual.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
That had just come out
news.
That
just breaking news.
Phoebe Robosa, I think, was that who it was? He was one of his mob tie friends he was supposedly having a sexual affair with.
Oh.
So. I mean, I think that the reality, just to answer that aside for a second, we have no language for thinking about our sexual identities. Like GLBT and straight are totally insufficient for describing the reality either today or in the past of how we understand ourselves as sexual beings. And the labels are important, but they also don't do anything justice. You know?
The beautiful idea behind Nixon's accidental support of gay rights was that sometimes political actions and political rivalries have unintended consequences. And one of those is that Chicago was able to participate. It was one of the third or fourth early gay rights parades. It was very much a grassroots and a bubbling and a focal point in the Midwest, if not the country, for progress.
Oh, yes.
So they could do different things when they weren't under the microscope.
But at the same time, I would say progress was not universally experienced by all people. So there was still police harassment of gay people, but it may be more police harassment of black gay people than there was of necessarily white gay people. So it doesn't end police harassment of people with same-sex desire. It just, it tries to rein in the rampant police corruption because Nixon's going after the Daily Machine.
And the word queer in describing these types of individuals, I going back to the sort of idea of researching, it was fascinating to me that it's like right now you're using the word queer because LGBT doesn't really do justice to describe who these individuals were. And, you know, I guess like it's even... Is that a challenge?
Well, it seems to me, too, academics are very comfortable using the word queer, whereas some people just absolutely hate that label.
Hate it.
Yeah. But academics said, you know what, it's fine and we like it.
The museum has become more and more comfortable using the word queer because we're using it in the exhibition. And some of our interpreters say, you know, I just don't know if I feel comfortable using that word because I feel like I'm not supposed to use that word. And I've said, well, if you can either explain why you're using it and how we got to this place, or if you don't feel comfortable, don't use it.
Like I said he-she earlier, because I assume somebody in the past would have said that. I would never call somebody a he-she, but...
But queer is one of the words we have on the wall in the exhibition. And we play with words on the walls.
Do you get much guff from, like... Because it seems to me that it's like either like younger or older people don't quite like it.
It's interesting because I think it's a word, it is a generational word, and I would say that the generation crosses people with same-sex desire with those who live their lives with opposite-sex desire. So there's a reluctance to use the word queer, like there's a reluctance to use the word faggot or the word dyke in a way that's been reclaimed by people under the age of 40, but... I still think that there's a lot of
stake. Word transgender.
Right.
I mean, you know, I've been doing this stuff for a long time before the word transgender even was being used to describe people of gender identities, of different gender identities. And looking back at my own archival footage, we didn't have that word transgender. We used transvestite, transsexual, or... what is it? Hermaphrodite.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so I guess what's really fascinating for you guys is that you get to see how these words change throughout time.
That's what I meant about when the graduate student Ann Parsons was doing this research. She had to figure out what the words were of the time, and then she could search for them. So once she found three or four examples, she would read them and then look for those words to find other things.
It's kind of like a Rosetta Stone.
It's exactly. It is a historical Rosetta Stone. That is exactly what it is. I call it sometimes with my students, it's a synonym list, a historical synonym list. And yes, the words may get you different things, but they're getting you kinships. They're getting you you're connecting dots. It is exactly a Rosetta Stone.
What
That's
is
perfect.
The relationship, since we're talking about words, so much of the words that we use to describe queer culture, LGBT culture, come from Polari and Oscar Wilde England, that time period. How did that all come to Chicago and the United States?
Like, oh my goodness.
You know, how did it get manifested, this small group of individuals and their words suddenly make its way through circles, through literature?
What's all the words like chicken,
drag,
a lot of those words.
Tea rooms.
I bet semen. They probably carried it over. The sailors. Yes, I meant sailors. Of that. Well, you know, in the section.
Ask our researchers, because we did with those words, mm-hmm. that we used on the walls was to provide at least 2 to 3 different examples of how they changed over time and the date in which we believe.
Even homosexual used to be homophile.
Homosexual, the origins of that word, it's got 2 different language types. Like, one is Greek and one is Latin.
I mean, homophile, mm-hmm. it means it's
yeah, but homosexual.
Friend of the same. Yeah. So it's like Philadelphia. The root word Phil is friend.
Greek.
It's Greek.
Uh-huh.
So it's, you know, same friend. It's, you know, you're a friend to like people.
And then homosexual mm-hmm. is not.
But homosexual is a relatively recent word. It's coined in the 1870s.
But it used to be used to describe things like the army or
the clergy.
Environments where it was only men or only women.
Right. Just like bisexual mm-hmm. didn't used to be about desire, but about bisexual from the 19th century is what we today think of as transgender.
Oh, interesting. So
that you were thought of as somebody, if you had bisexual. Both sexes, you were bisexual, which we now today call transgender.
Or intersex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But bisexual now means about your desire, not about who you think you are.
And Mark's laughing because he's saying,
I know a guy who said he was bisexual, but that just meant he could fit 2 dicks up his ass.
Oh my God.
That's a good story.
He thought that's what it meant.
Let's get that posted to the museum's website. Come on.
We need to reprint our label for the wall. Our word on the wall.
Let's talk about the past, though, because, you know, one of the sections you feature is Are You Family? And it's about creating, like, queer private spaces. And you talk about Jane Addams, who was a progressive woman. She spent her life with women. She received a Nobel Peace Prize. And you guys outed her after her death, even though that's the one thing that she didn't want to happen to her. She didn't want to come out of the closet.
One Did you feel thing any guilt said, about you know, that? we were asked this, uh-huh. this questions like this before the exhibition opened, and at least my response, I would say our response is that we aren't outing anyone in this exhibition, and we aren't outing Jane Addams. She wasn't a lesbian.
Then why is she featured?
Because she made her life with other women, and that we today assume that that means that she was a lesbian is on us, mm-hmm. not on her. And so one of the things that's amazing about Jane Addams is precisely that. I mean, in that respect, what we're outing, and I'm saying that with quotes, mm-hmm. is that she had an intimate private life that we're now talking about in public.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that that's what she would have bristled at, was the discussion of her private personal life, however you characterize it. That didn't belong in public space. So in that respect, we are doing something that she would not have been comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not about the other woman part. It's about there's a distinction between public and private.
And I guess Jane Addams has been sort of like in people's minds recently with this film that came out we were talking about.
Well, the Jane Addams Hall House just closed because she was a worker reformer, and so she had she built a settlement house for workers to come and stay. You know, because at the turn of the century, I mean, people were just treated like garbage in the environment, in the factories and the workhouses. So she gave a safe space for people to kind of get on their feet and move on.
So the museum is still open.
Okay.
The museum that was part of what's left of the settlement house, which is on the UIC campus. The social service agency that is in the legacy of Jane Addams mm-hmm. did just close.
Yeah.
Which is known as Hull House Association.
Let me ask you this. How do I explain to somebody like my mother why it's important to out somebody from the past when she says something? It's not important. The work is what matters, or their contribution. Because you often find that I tried
Why
to explain to my mother with Grant Woods, who was an Iowa painter. I gave her the book, and she's like, it's all about him being gay. Why does it have to be about him being gay? Why can't it just be about his work? Why do we care that these historical figures may or may not be gay?
I have something to say in response. Okay. It might not be what you're after, but what I was going to say is that one of the authors who contributed an essay to our mm-hmm. book out in Chicago, which goes along with the exhibition, her name is Victoria Bissell Brown, and she's at Grinnell, and she asked that very same question. Mm-hmm. Is Jane Addams queer or not? What is she? And do we even care? Does it matter? Mm-hmm. It's an excellent rumination and reflection on those issues. I don't know. I'm not necessarily comfortable outing anyone. Mm-hmm. I think that biography, though, can be tremendously influential and important in knowing those details of someone's life that really did shape the course of their lives and their action and their beliefs. I think that can be very powerful. But I think mm-hmm. it really depends on the person. I don't know that I have one answer to
that. I might answer the question differently and say that we know at this moment in time, we're pretty convinced that people's private lives have public implications. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then there's a reason to understand people's motivations aren't just about their public selves. Mm-hmm. We believe in a much more interior, we have a much more interior sense of who we are. Like when you ask your mother, who are you? Mm-hmm. How did you get to be who you are? It has to do with her private life. How did you come to make that quilt? Or how did you come to, you know, live in this place and have this many children or that many children? Or how do you see yourself in relationship to your grandchildren? Like, that's about her interior self. And I think part of it is that we're just so convinced that anything related to LGBT is about some kind of illicit sex. Right. Or it's just about fucking. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not what it is. But that's all sometimes we can see. And it is about fucking, too.
Well,
don't tell your mother that.
Well, we move beyond sort of the personal as political. We assume it's so.
Correct.
It's no longer a difference of opinion. It's seen very much as a fact. And with social media, we're all very intimately aware of our personal lives as public information.
But we're also, I think, increasingly maybe coming to terms with what it means to say that the political is personal.
Okay.
So the reverse of that. So the 70s feminists.
So we're moving backwards in.
I don't think it's backwards. No? I think it's acknowledging that the way that political change has an effect on our personal interior lives. And saying that someone is political, saying that the person is political is right.
The attention is moving out from instead of from the inside out to the public space, it's moving from the outside space into the inside.
I would say they're happening.
It's a circulation happening.
What Jenny's talking about there, too, I think happens in the exhibit through the video, the interviews that we've done, which I think for me at least represent the heart of the exhibit, the energy. They really allow people to make the connections, and people in very powerful, personal, visceral ways are revealing this history to us as well as the present, and bringing all of the artifacts and the stories to life. And it's a tremendously personal, sharing the personal, making your private life public can be both. And it's also a way to make history, and it can also be a form of activism through the museum.
So let's quickly touch on the Chapin and Gore paintings at the Men's Bar. Which, how did you guys come to acquire those paintings?
Well, that's the Mining the Museum. That's the best example.
Now, describe these paintings to people and why. I mean, they're just extraordinary paintings.
They're beautiful.
They were donated by someone who ended up purchasing some of the property, and they came to the museum in the 1930s. Some of them have been on display in the 50s and in decades to come. Sometimes, I guess they used to decorate the hallways of the administrative offices.
And these paintings came from a bar. This bar had several locations in the city.
A men's saloon.
And it was a men's saloon, and this kind of became a defect. These were gay bars.
And they were political. No.
They were kind of
political cartoons of famous people at the time, and they usually would, some of them would portray them in drag. And
so there's a lot going on. It's not, okay. So exactly. There's a lot going on. The bars were men's spaces, so they were what historians call homosocial spaces, so where men were together. There was clearly some trick turning, but they were not gay bars. Okay. They were not the predecessor of, you know,
the manhandler,
touche or whatever. Mm-hmm. impressive that I could say that right. Hydrate. as a lesbianness, I do know that there are clubs. But they were these spaces where, in fact, mocking people for being gender nonconforming or being or sort of thinking that people were what we would today call gay was a way of mocking them, was a way of caricaturing them and making fun of them. So there would, you sort of imagine, we saw these pictures of these saloons that were, you know, like a bar, a thin bar with a huge, you know, wooden bar. And there would be like 50 of these 3-foot-tall oil paintings lining the walls, like how, like if a bar is known for having caricatures drawn on the wall, like Harry Carriers or whatever that place is called, like that's what draws people in. This was these 3-foot-tall oil paintings. And a lot of them had content that is queer. And so that's what we're trying to do, is capture that sense that this was one of the ways that these people were made fun of was that they were here.
And it would be the equivalent of if you wanted to do a political cartoon and identify somebody as gay, they would hold a rainbow flag.
Exactly.
But in these paintings, one of the guys holding a little banner that says Chicago Athletic Association.
Well, just is a C that looks like the Cubs, but it is, we found out. They're also all wearing red ties in that picture.
So straight men knew that wearing a red tie was kind of a gay thing.
Some of them. So clearly.
At least enough in that club.
At least for the people who commissioned the painting, they were in the know, and those decisions were made to caricature these people, and they were in the know.
And it's questionable how and why they were in the know. Mm-hmm. Like, were they
gay themselves? Said, let's make fun of this because it's kind of, because I mean, we do that kind of stuff all the time.
For example,
things like
mocking.
That.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I think for some of the people like Oscar Wilde or Dr. Mary Walker, if you tended to be more politically outspoken and you were on the queer side, they would tap into that and exaggerate those aspects of you, but also mock you for your political positions.
But the Chapin, but the Oscar, no.
The Aidan Wells.
But the Aidan Wells were, it's pretty clear that they were lifelong partners of each other, and we don't know the nature of that relationship, but they traveled together, they used the same mailing address, they lived their lives together. We don't know whether they were lovers, and we're not suggesting that they were, but the painting in many ways is suggesting that they were, so whether they actually were or they weren't doesn't act so much matter. And so there's the symbols that tell us that that painting, which, as Jill said, has hung in the museum before. It was the cover of the big picture exhibit catalog. Mm-hmm. It's a prized possession of the museum, but it had never been talked about as being queer.
So it had been shown, it had been on the cover, but nobody said this means this, this means that. And
nobody said anything.
Even like to say this guy's wearing a dress.
Like he's wearing a dress.
No. I'm wondering if you guys were considering covering or talking about in the exhibit, and why this didn't make it, or at least I didn't get to see it, is the film industry of the turn of the century in Chicago certainly brought a lot of LGBT queer people into the city. Most famously, Charlie Chaplin's SNA Studios filmed, which I just quickly Googled, I may be wrong on this, but A Woman, which shows Charlie Chaplin in drag, was filmed in 1915 here in Chicago.
Yeah,
You're killing me.
We wanted it in the exhibit.
Why? What happened?
Let's talk about didn't make it.
I rented that, and I took I made my own film stills watching that movie on Netflix. And he's beautiful. He looks so beautiful.
He's hot.
I know.
Yeah.
And so the museum has a wonderful SNA archive collection as well as photographs. We have a couple of film cans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's one of those stories that ended up on the cutting room floor. And, you know, we had to make some really careful decisions. And I think there was a question about, you know, how far do you go we don't know anything about Charlie Chaplin. We knew that he and some of the actors in the company played with gender, and it certainly was done for humorous effect. Mm-hmm. Another movie that they did, Shanghaied, is believed to be one of the first portrayals of a homosexual in a negative way, sort of like a fairy sailor. And there was also an exchange. There's a scene with Chaplin and a cabin boy that is potentially homosexually erotic or homoerotic.
Ooh, I've got to see that.
But you know,
Charles Chappell is a gorgeous man.
You know, maybe we should do a blog post about this or something, because we ended up just we had to cut it out and make choices, and we felt that it wasn't as.
Certainly, you know, the exhibit is very expansive. What else didn't make it? What else were you kind of like, oh, I wish we could fit this in there, but we just can't?
The disco demolition.
Oh, with Steve Dahl?
Mm-hmm.
When he's declared disco is dead.
Disco sucks.
Do you kind of feel that was a very homophobic act? Or?
There is no doubt in my mind, and the historical accounts of it are pretty clear, mm-hmm. that the way disco was attacked by White Sox fans in 1979 at Kaminsky Park mm-hmm. was as much about a sort of attack on the racial and sexual politics of disco as it was on reclaiming or buttressing a kind of white rock and roll mm-hmm. in you know, countering disco.
Popular culture.
Right. Yeah.
So quickly, Steve Dahl was a radio disc jockey. He thought he was going to do a public relations stunt and invited all the fans to bring their disco albums to set them on fire. Mm-hmm. And what happened was a riot.
Yeah. A melee.
And they had to forfeit the game. It almost cost Steve Dahl's career.
Yeah.
And to this day, he feels horrible about it and apologized.
Yeah. No, it's so I think the way I would answer the question about what didn't make it is mm-hmm. that there were times when things didn't make it because we just couldn't fit it into the story that we decided we wanted to tell and the way mm-hmm. we wanted to tell it. And then there were things that didn't make it because there were fears. I think how to represent homophobia.
Sure.
Really, like, can you critique homophobia and represent it at the same time? And I think that was one of the things that really became difficult. We couldn't quite get our minds around how you did. We could and we couldn't. We were sometimes successful and sometimes not. And so the things that are often cut are things that are violently homophobic, you know?
Murders and rapes.
Well,
like
whatever.
That.
Like, mm-hmm. or I would say the other thing that that isn't there as much as I would like is homoerotic desire.
The pleasure.
So the pleasure piece isn't there as much as I would like.
Well, make it sure.
I was just going to say, I think there was as much a nervousness of, you know, what will happen if we say that Jane Addams is a lesbian? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I think it was as much of a fear.
You did get in trouble, though, didn't you, with one of the people, Allerton? Didn't you kind of say that he was gay and then somebody
came
forward?
We had a typo in the label that we had to correct.
Okay.
So we were actually writing about two different Allertons.
But people were still upset.
They
were upset.
Gays.
People were upset that we called him gay, even though they were upset.
That is true.
Them.
I mean, there are figures from Chicago history, and he is one, and Addams is certainly another that there are many people, historians in the city, who feel protective of them. But I think there is as much worry of, you know, outing someone as a homophobe mm-hmm. as there is perhaps outing someone who is gay.
I think
interesting.
That's right.
Well, one thing that you did get right is that you guys got us into the exhibit.
Well, in the book, not the exhibit.
Oh, yes, we did.
You mentioned Feast of Fun, the podcast, because, you know.
But you did get in the exhibit. You saw it.
I did. I squeezed myself in. But and that was the most exciting part of the exhibit by any stretch of the imagination. I want to talk about, because Chicago has been in the center and the forefront of so many types of movements that we don't necessarily associate with gay and lesbian rights.
Yes.
That have pushed progress forward. First of all, the Stonewall. Stonewall took place in New York City, but Chicago is one of the first cities to participate in gay pride parades, in gay rights movement. It was one of the first to organize. Then came my HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And the response to that certainly came from Chicago as well.
Mm-hmm.
Daytime talk shows, Oprah, and Chicago really sort of like pushed forward people's awareness of gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender identity and what these people actually even look like.
Mm-hmm. Even the publishing industry here, Johnson Publications,
sure.
Johnson Publishing through Ebony and Jet really propelled national conversation about what it means to be black and gay mm-hmm. in America.
And Black History Month was born out of the YMCA on the South Side.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, part of it is sure. the largest argument of the exhibition is that Chicago and of the museum in general is that Chicago is a crossroads of America. It's a place where things happen, mm-hmm. where where bad things happen, where good things happen, where violence happens, where possibility is made. It's the constant influx of people, whether it's Eastern and Southern European immigrants in the 19th century or immigrants from Mexico in the Bracero movement of the 1930s and 40s, or whether it's African immigration of today, or whether it's the railroads going in and out of the city, or whether it's the fact that, you know, we have this river that attaches one part of the country to the other part of the country. It's a place where change happens. And that's part of the story of the exhibition. And so I think it helps explain some of these things. It's a it's a place where change happens.
Chicago is well known for its gay newspaper tycoons and its controversy. For at one time, we had 8 simultaneous gay newspapers being sold and advertised in at one point in time. And it's old. I think it's actually one of the nation's oldest LGBT newspapers, which was Gay Life, which became Windy City Times. And Jeff McCourt helped to popularize mainstream advertisers to advertising in gay media, and sort of like helped push forward the concept of a gay dollar or gay market to, you know, automobile manufacturers. Why does Chicago have so many goddamn newspapers?
Well, it was a publishing capital.
Because of the fact that these companies were here already and they were just like interacting with each other.
That's certainly part of it. It has a long history of being a very rambunctious press town. So like newspapers of the 19th century were constantly doing battle with each other to see who could get either the best story, the best drawing. Like, you tell it this way, we tell it this way. You're the paper of industry, we're the paper of the people. You know,
the Sun-Times versus the
Tribune. Well, the Daily News. The Sun-Times versus the Tribune is today's version, but there's like 6 newspapers in the 19th century.
So Chicago's always sort of had that battle happening as well.
Yeah.
Well, I think also, too, because the city's always been very segregated against race lines and you know, ethnic lines. So each kind of minority would have their own paper as well.
There's that.
Although labor unions had their own papers, too.
I mean, that's what I mean. It's a town where change and tumult and, I mean, the rapid population growth of this city over the course between the 1850s and the 1950s, I mean, it's almost impossible for us to understand. It goes from like 1,000 people in 1830 to
300,000 in 1870.
I mean, it's
that's a lot of
it's
people.
A lot
and by
of
the
people.
Turn of the century,
it's just, you know, it's crazy. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating exhibition, and it's running in Chicago till March
26th.
March 26th.
Any chance it'll get extended?
I'm hoping that I will be pleasantly surprised on March 26th, but we might just have to settle for having the nice long run that we had when it opened on May 21st. I wish I could tell you yes, but we'll have to wait and see.
So
in the meantime, please come in.
So you won't know until March 26th.
Well, I think we'll know a little bit before, but
maybe a little bit before.
It's like theater, they'll extend it.
But you know what? We are free. The museum is free all this month.
For Illinois residents, the museum is free for the month of February.
Mm-hmm. So you have to like show your ID or something?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you know. I was going to ask you, Jill, if you thought that people had to have a state ID or if they could come in. I meant to ask you before we got here.
I assume most people would have. Most people that are listening to this that live in Chicago probably have ID.
Mm-hmm.
What role, sort of like a new media, blogs, podcast, video blogging, has taken in Chicago and in advancing LGBT equality, and also social media, and how does it manifest itself here in the exhibit? Because you guys do have like a video component to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the History Museum has a long-standing blog, and we have regularly an amazing undergraduate who studies with me at UIC, Morgan Valenzuela, has been writing blogs for that. So she's been talking some about what's on the cutting room floor. We have these videos that we're collecting, so we're sort of making an archive of material that have been collected in the story station, which is in the last section of the exhibit. And there is a Facebook page that has 3,000 likes, but I mean, I think we're really at this place where we want to figure out how to use social media to allow this thing that has been in a brick and mortar building to live on in some other way. So all of the family videos are on the YouTube channel for the History Museum.
As well as the blog.
And that's been really wonderful.
And it's great. You guys have gotten so much of your video footage up on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
Which is, you know.
And we still need to do more, but we're.
I love looking at all the gay pride parades. Like, we were having a big debate on the internet because everyone was saying that this footage of Art
San
Johnson.
Francisco was, you know, was someplace
else.
Well,
it was obviously it was Art Johnson and Pepe, two of the owners of Sidetrack, of a big gay bar in Chicago, and they're sitting on the hood of a car driving a gay pride parade on the corner of Belmont and Halsted. Very obvious where it is. And all these New York-centric blogs were insisting that it was in New York that it took place.
No, San Francisco.
Or San Francisco, yeah.
Francisco, we're like,
no. Same thing.
And it's interesting, you know, and what's this one frustration that we have is that, you know, that media and content and pioneers that come from Chicago tend to be looked down upon by the coastal cities.
True. In all things gay. Gay history, too.
A gay history.
You know?
Well, this
so
is
there
a
are books on the history of gay life in San Francisco, and there are books on the history of gay life in Chicago. There is no single monograph, historical monograph, on gay life in Chicago.
Until now.
Well, but not, like, the exhibition is one of the first things, but there's no, like, 300-page book about gay LGBT life in Chicago. Like, there is Gay
like
New
an
York.
Encyclopedia of
or
of
even
its kind.
Just, like, a regular, I mean, a history book. I guess The Secret Historian may be the closest thing.
Yeah. I mean, the book that we did is a compilation. We wrote an essay about the exhibition, but some of the other essays are really documenting some of the most popular talks from the Out at CHM program.
I'm very proud of this exhibit, and I'm very proud of you guys for putting this together. And you say it's like a one-of-a-kind exhibit, that, like, there's never been anything put on by any city anywhere of this scale or this magnitude.
Mm-hmm. And what it does is knit LGBT history and LGBT people into the fabric of Chicago itself.
Mm-hmm.
You will learn so much about Chicago history by coming to this exhibit, and you will see that it isn't just about one community or one period of time. It spans our history, and it spans our city.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that you guys also managed to get the history of lesbian flyers and their potluck parties.
Well, you know, we have a full run of Lavender Woman in our holdings at the museum. So,
and also, like, the Chicago Women's Liberation Rock Band, I would just like to say, is in the show. And you can listen to it when you go in. You can hear them singing. Mm-hmm. Moving Woman.
And it's on iTunes.
We listened to it while we wrote labels. Yeah. We rocked out.
What is the song?
Mountain Moving Woman.
Mountain. We'll play it at the end of the song.
Chicago Women's Liberation Rock Band.
So that's what we play at the end. Mountain. What is the title of the song?
Mountain Moving Woman.
Over again.
Moving Woman. Because there was a coffee shop or
yes.
A,
the Mountain Moving,
the Mountain
coffee,
Moving
shop.
Coffee Shop.
It's now defunct, though.
Correct.
Right? You need to bring it back.
And I think you can order a CD. There's an order on a CD on Amazon you can order.
So Mountain Moving Woman and two women here that move mountains.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to have the both of you here. It's really just a lovely exhibit, and I really want to thank you guys in the Chicago Historical Museum for his history museum for doing this, because it's really just extraordinary.
Thank you so much.
It's Jill Austin and Jennifer Breyer, and you can follow them on you guys are like on Twitter or Facebook or where?
I'm not on Twitter.
You're not? Well, how do people like communicate with you and tell and express their
on,
like
on the Facebook
gratitude?
Page
on the Facebook
for
page
for Out in Chicago.
Okay, and that's facebook.com/outinchicago.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, so that is all we have for you guys today, and we want to recommend that you guys subscribe to the podcast if you're not subscribed, and recommend your friends to become Feast of Fun Plus listeners.
Visit feastoffun.com/plus and sign up today and get all delicious 5 shows a week in your iTunes.
Thank you so much for coming
on
the show.
Thank
guys.
You so much.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
With courage, we join hands to bridge that gulf of hate. our shall be remain. We are mountain moving women, called by justice to wear in the spirit's gentle power and the strength of our love. Our earth shall be reclaimed. Hear the voices, the hungry ones who cry, finding their breath in uphill struggle. No easy answer here, no third world panacea. Our earth must be remade. We are mountain moving women, called by justice to wear in the spirit's gentle power and the strength of our love. Our earth shall be reclaimed. Feel the fear of nations without trust, building up a mountain of weapons. If together we shall know, we can pull that mountain down. Our earth shall be remade. We are mountains.